So today is the Upasita day, the observance day. So it's a lovely ritual that we go through every fortnight. That we come together and remember the kind of protocols and rules and agreements that we live by. And every fortnight we get a chance to remember why we started this work, and why we picked up this particular way of practice, why we as bhikkhus took upasampada, sila dharas, took ordination. What was it that brought us here? And I always find that very helpful to keep in mind my aspiration and intention. And this fortnightly gathering is a very beautiful way of remembering that. And that remembering also is that we're doing this together as a community. It's not just an individual it is an individual aspiration, but also it's in the context of a whole community of people with a similar aspiration. So our love and respect for each other, our love and respect for the Buddha, these are, to me, very much part of the patimokkha or any kind of like corporate taking of precepts. Seems to me that's what it's indicating. So there's the personal aspiration and there's the kind of agreement to do this as a community. And this is very rare in the world, I think. I've just been traveling quite a bit and these places are rather marvelous, really. I mean, I haven't been here since 1999. I was here for the opening, and this kind of cathedral-like building is quite stunning. Coming into this hall, there's the silence. You hear the silence. And yet we're all pretty ordinary people, aren't we? Yes. This is what I find extraordinary. We're just sort of ordinary folk trying to get enlightened or be better people, and yet what manifests around us is this beauty, this generosity, and we have this chance to practice here. Chithurst, my own monastery now, Tisarana. I was up with Ajahn Manindo. So I feel really, really fortunate to have this kind of opportunity. I doubt if any of us find it easy. The ordained life or lay life, it's life itself is challenging. And then trying to practice in a way which has integrity and consistency and love in it it's hard to maintain that. It's hard to maintain that path. So our kind of communal gatherings are ways of helping each other in that way, reinforcing that aspiration that we have. As most of you know, I've been out of the loop, out of the monastic circuit for 10 years. I left Amaravati in 99, just a bit of autobiography, and then I was quite exhausted being in Amaravati. I was in over my head. I was out of my depth totally, so I needed a good long rest. So I had various self-retreats for a couple of years, and this is the wonderful thing of our communities, that we do have these opportunities to support each other and do that, retreats like that. And then my mother fell, and she broke her pelvis. She was in Ottawa, I was in New Zealand. So I went out to care for her, and I could see when she was already 87. It wasn't a spring chicken. And I could see that there was just no way she should be alone. And I didn't want her to go into an old folks home, so I decided that I would try to stay with her and learn how to practice as a bhikkhu in mom's condominium. And that was, she didn't believe me at first. For the first year, she said, "When are you going? When are you going? I'm staying. When are you going?" "No, I'm staying." And so this was a, for us who are in monastic life, it's an interesting challenge when we are outside of our monastic protection, say, our monastic privilege. We're so well cared for in these monastic settings, or outside of Thailand, say, and being in non-Buddhist situations, in situations where it's really not understood why we get about the way we do, our rules, to see how we do adapt to different kind of environment. I know when I went back the first time in 1977, I went to visit my family first time. So I'd been in the robe for about four and a half years. And I was, I really blew it. I was very awkward and very clumsy with my family, as often we do when we come into a different kind of environment. But this time I did it much better. This time I had much more confidence. And just trying to figure out, so what is the bhikkhu life? What is my culture as a bhikkhu? And what is my mum's life? And what is her culture? And I find it arrogant in myself if I always think that my Buddhist bhikkhu culture has to be the uppermost culture in any social situation, that everyone has to serve me as if they were disciples of Ajahn Chah. To me, that seems a kind of piece of arrogance. And why? You know, why should people? You know, why can't I adapt to other people's culture? It's a kind of contemplation I've often had. Why is my cultural situation more important than their cultural situation? So anyway, with my mother, I could see that it wasn't just her cultural situation, it was her physical situation that was more important than all my rule keeping. So I tried to work out a way where I would keep to my moral discipline, I would keep to my monastic discipline, but I could still care for her. And so, just some issues, you know, the usual issues around food, and like what some of our rules are, we can't be alone with a woman. Well, my mother's 86, I can't be alone with her. You know, so then what we can see with our rules is that we have, you know, there is an allowance for confession. You know, we can't say that, okay, during this fortnight, I stepped outside these boundaries, but I stepped outside these boundaries for these particular reasons. And so just to share with you, the way I worked it out was I went to Ajahn Sumedho, went to Ajahn Pasanno, and I just told him, "This is what I'm doing. This is how I'm living." They said, "Fine, great. I mean, if you can't take care of your mother, what's the point of this life?" And so I found a way to keep my own formal practices going, my own meditation practices, but most importantly, what was most important was just to take care of my mom, you know, to wash her when necessary, to feed her when necessary, to just be with her, make her a garden. And this is quite wonderful. It was a really, as I say to people, of the two best things I've done in my life is become a monk, take care of my mom. Really, honestly. Now, having said that, me and my mom are good. She passed away a year and a half ago, so we were really good mates. So we had one disagreement in 9 years, which lasted 15 minutes. So that's kind of special. I realize not everyone has such a clear, open relationship with their parents, and it can be kind of stressful. But one of the things perhaps that is difficult in bhikkhu life, in monastic life, is loving self-surrender, loving self-sacrifice. I think in lay life that might be actually an easier piece to develop, because well, parents' relationship to children or good marriage, and that there is a kind of loving bond there that exists, and so self-sacrifice comes from a deep sense of love and care. And you know, if I think of the way my mom cared for me during her refugee years, and like when we came to Canada, they had no money, and she said she gave her food to the kids. She didn't eat hardly at all, and you think, wow, that's amazing. And it was so natural for her. So you think about it in our monastic life, that loving bond we have with someone it's different, isn't it? It's different. Sometimes we feel very devoted to our teachers. So I know with Ajahn Chah, it was, you know, one had a tremendous sense of bhakti to him. I mean, he was such an exceptional being. And then that bhakti allows a lot of self-sacrifice. A lot of sense of service, and a really wonderful opening of the heart. So being with my mom, it was this kind of marvelous opportunity of practicing the Brahmaviharas day in and day out, just in a very natural, very simple, very natural way. Metta, obviously, the sense of wishing her well was very obvious. Karuna was very obvious. She had a lot of pain. She had osteoporosis and arthritis, and she was legally blind, but she was quite with it, able to get around on a walker most of the time. And just to serve someone like that, to look out for them. I found that our training in Acharyavatta, our training in Upatak, brilliant. You know, the way we are trained to look out for our teachers, how we are trained to anticipate their needs, how we are trained to look and see what do they like. Do they like black tea or green tea? Do they like sugar? Do they like honey? That kind of sensitivity in service, which I learned with Lompo Cha or Lompo Sumeto, this really comes into play with someone like who is very old, because their needs are considerable, and you can do so much for an old person. You can do so much. And just little things, like I noticed that my mother was fumbling with the lamps. She was fumbling around, so I put light switches in all the cords just at the height her hand was, either in the chair or in the bed. Little thing, but made a huge difference to her life. And that kind of caregiving, I think it's natural, but the way we are trained as monastics to really look out, how can I help you? How can I make your life more easy? How can I make your life more graceful? Comes into play, that kind of sensitivity and sense of observation. And so as able to just facilitate mom's difficult physical life. At that age is, for most people, it's a bummer. my mom kept saying, she just wanted out. Not in any morose way, just in a natural way. Enough with the pain, enough with the tiredness, and so on. And so, it was interesting trying to keep her mind from not getting depressed, just to kind of keep her somehow interested in things, so her mind wouldn't sink. And so I'd do things like, I'd get fashion catalogs, and I'd go through fashion catalogs with my mother. it's not my forte. And yet it was interesting when you really love someone, right? You kind of look for ways of so what would make you happy rather than what's going to make me happy. And so then we'd go through an L.L. Bean catalog or something, and then she'd look at something she could hardly read it. Then I kind of figure out, is that, you know, what are you going to look like in that? And it was really quite fun going shopping with a 90-year-old lady having no money and not knowing anything. But these are the kind of small joys of caring for someone, which then lift the other person's heart, because they see you, you care for them, and it gives them a different perspective. The kind of the loneliness of the elderly is profound, because I don't think we are meant to be alone. You know, we are social beings. And it's not just physically taking care of an elderly person, it's taking care of their hearts, taking care of their minds, tuning into to what they need. And one of the interesting dances me and my mom did, not that she could dance much, and not that I do dance, but that she, this kind of sensitivity that we had to each other, she knew how to read me and I knew how to read her, and she would never complain to me. She'd tell me if something hurt, and I could see when she was very much consumed with her own pain. I'd know that she's quiet because of that, but she would never complain to me. I'd hear her complaining sometimes to some very good physiotherapists that came, but she'd never complain to me. And I realized she was doing that because she was worried that I would worry. So she loved me so much that she didn't complain, and me with her, you know. Because I felt pretty exhausted at times, I said, yeah, that's not her problem. So I always try to remain upbeat. So what you have is two people who raise their consciousness above the sort of negativity and difficulty of a situation out of love. And it's really, quite marvelous. So a kind of meditation on the Brahma Viharas in a very, very open and natural way. One of the nice pieces I always had was like, I took care of her for about 4 years, and then I was getting a bit tired by then, and so I asked people in Ottawa if they'd be interested in starting a forest monastery. So we started Tisarana, and that was a great relief, because it gave me weekends where I could have some rest, and Ajahn Kuslo came, and he was so kind to get the place up and running, and he would just let me go to my room and then my kuti, and it was very, very restful. So that gave me the kind of samana sanya, relationship with a sangha, which was so important to kind of be plugged into a sangha. And then I'd go on a Saturday morning, and I'd to Tisarana, and I'd have a meal, teach a bit, go to my kuti and crash out or meditate or whatever. And then I'd go back and see Mom. I'd go back to Mom on Saturday, on the Sunday evening. So I'd be away from Saturday morning to Sunday evening. And then when I went back, I always, I bought her cut flowers, because she loves flowers. And then I'd go up to the condominium, and she'd be very happy to see me. And then I'd show her the flowers, and then her face would just be radiant with happiness. And then I took a mental snapshot of that. I just pictured that. And then I brought that into my meditation. I just picture her. I just see her smile. I'd see her happiness. And of course, you know, I'd feel happy. And that's very much the practice of mudita, and the practice of feeling someone else's happiness and really feeling happy for their happiness. And so I found the deepening of the Brahma Viharas in this very, very real way, where I began to see how we can use emotional memory, not as storyline, but as heart feeling that gets stimulated, gets triggered, becomes more vibrant through remembering. So the simple act of recollecting, this idea of recollection we have in the practices of mindfulness, just recollecting my mom's joy as a picture, and then as a heart-centered feeling, very real, and then just abiding in that. This is mudita, this is joy. Abiding in that and reinforcing that. And so the heart begins to remember what joy is about, begins to feel viscerally in the heart what joy is about. And then just repeating that kind of activity and pattern. And through that, I found that my attention tended to abide more with the center of my heart rather than the thinking mind. Still enjoyed going there because it likes to do that, but just to to find an alternative place to allow consciousness to sit in the seat of the heart. I found very, very lovely. And then compassion too, just feeling, feeling for my mom's situation and try to act, around that was always in the center of the heart. And that stimulation of that, I think, is very important in our lives, because if our Dhamma remains just intellectual, then it becomes a kind of, it becomes very arid, to say the least. It becomes very, very dry. And Theravada Buddhism has tremendously beautiful intellectual structures. Very difficult sometimes to get your head around, lots of lists, Patichasamuppada, Four Noble Truths, Wings of Awakening, so the lists go on and on and on. And there's a huge difference between having an intellectual set of principles or guidelines or teachings that are merely left as that, because that doctrine which is just left as intellectual knowledge either becomes dogma or just remains as a kind of artifact that you remember as a piece of knowledge. But liberation is the doctrine is not to be just left as knowledge, it's to be used as something to actually awaken the heart. And so something like the Brahma Viharas is a kind of recommendation that we investigate what it really means to have empathy. What does that actually mean? So we bring up the language of that empathy. Well, what is empathy? Rather than, yeah, Brahma Viharas as a list, something very good to do. One of the sort of things I notice with elderly people is there that elderly people oftentimes don't have avenues of generosity. They don't have avenues of expression. They don't have avenues of giving because they're so stuck in their physical form. And I found that with my mother, you could see that much of her joy is in giving and serving like any human being, or gardening, and those avenues of expression were no longer there. So she kind of, you know, like as we went through the shopping catalog, she said, "What do you want?" So I got more and more socks, I think. Great collection of socks. You know, what do I need? So when we have a chance to serve, I think we all see that, don't we? It's like people, you know, you'll serve someone, right? And they'll say thank you, and then we'll say thank you back, don't we? And why is that? Because they are giving us an opportunity to actually make that empathetic connection, to come to the Brahma Viharas in a very concrete way, not just in an abstract way. And so when we have those opportunities, I think it's very, very beautiful, useful, lovely, timely to engage them, to really engage them, and then begin to use that engagement to remember the heart, and then to strengthen that in our meditation, so that the Brahma Viharas meditation isn't something which is just intellectual. May I be well, may you be well, but really comes down from the head into the heart. And that the heart center has that kind of stimulation which I think is very important for our kind of balanced existence. And then that more heart-centered practice, it makes awareness, I think, a different kind of a game. Awareness practice can be a kind of continual critical practice. Awareness can be a continual kind of control practice. Awareness can be, if done wrongly, it can be a continual kind of evaluation. But I think heart-centered practices are much more receptive. You know, when you think about how empathy works, empathy isn't a sort of like trying to go out to something, it's allowing something to come to you. It's much more like listening. Listening is very empathetic. When you listen to something, you allow it to come into consciousness. If you just listen to the silence, you need to listen to the silence in the room, you have to wait. You have to be present. You have to be available. You have to allow the silence to come to you, don't you? And so I think the heart practices help that. When awareness has that quality of empathy in it around all the ordinariness of life, then I think we come to a true understanding of the way things are. Think about how any of you who've done any kind of social work, counseling, talking with people, that, you know, to really understand someone, you have to first listen, don't you? You have to let them come into your consciousness. You have to feel whatever they're trying, you know, they're saying to you. You have to feel it. If you approach them with a kind of trying to figure them out or try to sort them out or try to have an answer, you're not available to them, right? You're not really available to who they are if there's no empathy. And in the same way, our own conscious experience, the difficulties we face as human beings, the problems and so on, I think true awareness has that empathetic quality in it. If I'm going to understand my own fears, my own biases, my own history, somehow I have to be present to that. I have to be available to that. I have to allow it to become conscious. When I allow it to become conscious, then I think there is understanding. But if I don't allow it to be conscious and my mind is always evaluating, trying to get rid of, become, or whatever, then I don't think there's true understanding there. When we meditate and we cultivate the sense of presence and such like, it's very, I've always found it very important to as I meditate, to really contemplate intention and effort. You know, how do I make effort? Why do I make effort? Well, what's actually happening when I do that? That seems to me the nub of the problem. And so often for myself, there's a kind of reaching forward and trying to do something about the present moment. And as long as I'm trying to do something about the present from some kind of agenda, some kind of preconceived notion of attainment, some kind of anticipation, then I cannot understand the moment. And if I cannot understand the moment, I can't really respond to it correctly. But when I can sit back, when can I allow the present moment to unfold, then insight can arise, something fresh can arise. Why? Because I become available. If I don't have that sense of openness, I don't think I can really understand. Now this is very difficult to do when there's pain. If I feel fear or some old memory of betrayal comes up or have physical pain, it's very hard to have the, it's very hard to allow that to become conscious because it is painful. And who wants pain? None of us want pain. And yet, as we develop this capacity to be available to things like fear or resentment or jealousy, these kinds of things, or physical pain, we begin to touch something in consciousness which is, of course, unchanging. Because in the deep difficulties of our practice, say for me, the deepest lesson I've had to learn are lessons around fear, all manners and flavors of fear. And so, if you think about something like fear, empathy towards fear is not a natural way to respond to it. For me, the natural way to respond to fear was to try to figure it out, to try to get rid of it, to do practices, to somehow not have it. So the natural or conditioned response is somehow some desire to get rid of, some desire to have some kind of other experience. And as long as I didn't see that the problem with, in my case, fear, was the desire not to have the fear, as long as I didn't notice that, then nothing worked. There was certainly lots of vigor and diligence and determination, but as long as there was this misunderstanding, as long as there was a preconceived notion from ignorance in the way I approach that, it always led to the same thing, just a sense of despair. And so the teaching around looking at desire, making conscious desire rather than getting rid of it or following it, is a teaching of a kind of, it's a kind of empathetic teaching. Let it become conscious. And yet desire is such a strong energy that we just react through it. So say something like the desire to get rid of fear. It seems so counterintuitive, not to try to get rid of fear, not to try to get rid of anger, not to try to get rid of jealousy. It almost seems counterintuitive. But when we do that, I find, when there is a kind of open-hearted awareness of the very presence of this in consciousness, then we begin to touch that which is not fear, truly not fear. We begin to touch, I think, the unchanging. And that's courageous work. Really hard to do. Very hard to do. You feel kind of intimidated by someone, or jealous of someone, or some old sense of betrayal comes up, or whatever, to actually be in that compassionate mode, in that empathetic mode with this feeling now, to be available fully to that, is not for the weak-hearted. It's hard, isn't it? And yet what other, I don't see any other way to do it. Any other way to do it. So as we sit in the fire of those kinds of feelings, then what happens is that the insight begins to dawn on us that even this is okay. Even this fear is okay. Or even this jealousy is okay. And we begin to trust more and more in something which is unchanging. In that clarity, open-hearted clarity to the way things are. And then we forget. And we lose the plot. And we get lost. And then something, why? We awaken again. We awaken again. So you're just kind of reflecting, obviously, I've been in Harnham, I've been in Chithurst, now I'm here. And then I was in New Zealand, and kind of traveling all over, just reflecting on the places I've been as a monk and the experiences I had. Certainly, I get overwhelmed lots of times. Wasn't aware, or got caught up, or got burnt out, or whatever. But somehow, we always come back to the same point, don't we? We come back to this, the only thing that makes sense is presence. The only place of abiding is knowing the way things are. It's the only thing that makes sense. And whenever we taste that, I think, whenever we taste this pure presence, whenever we really are with the way things are, I think acknowledging that in a kind of optimistic way, yeah, I'm back again. No matter how lost we get, how foolish we might, be or whatever, or how awful our behaviors become, or whatever we've said, at some moment we wake up. We wake up to this moment the way it is. And to really treasure that, and to acknowledge that, rather than just to dwell in the history of failure, the history of regret, but to actually value that the only way out is this present moment awareness. The only way out is non-becoming. So my own struggles with fear, allowing fear to come through the body, seeing that like body witnessing something like fear. I wasn't used to doing that. I was used to kind of localizing my attention, look at the breath, or control the mind, or do some kind of a practice with a kind of agenda. But I found as I did a kind of body witnessing practice, so witnessing to this difficult emotion called fear or panic or anxiety, and allowing the body to witness it, allowing the body to feel it in the guts, in the heart, in the hands, in the neck, to kind of have this sort of kind of open, empathetic way of being with fear, was foreign to me. In the beginning, it was more thinking about fear, or thinking fearful thoughts, or planning talks, or organizing my life some way where I wouldn't have fear. It was all intellectual, all thought, analysis, and that really didn't answer the problem, because it wasn't really witnessing to that particular energy. And so our practices of body awareness, I think they are very receptive practices, you know. They're practices which allow the energy forms of greed, hatred, and delusion to manifest. But because we open to them in this very body witnessing way, their energies go, they process through us. We feel them in the guts, we feel them in the heart. Right? But because we no longer have an agenda of getting rid of them or closing them down, as they process through us, our body begins to be liberated from them. And as our body's liberated from them, our mind is liberated from them. And this is the beauty of practices in the heart or in the stomach or in the body. They don't lie. Thoughts, if you notice, thoughts are often lying. Yeah? I don't know about your mind, but the thinking mind can just spin stories around, rationalizations, blame, you know, the whole business, the whole nine yards. But the body doesn't lie. The body feels, and we are mind-body, we are mind-body experiences, aren't we? I mean, that's what our living existence presents to us. So there is a way of entering into our karma, entering into the difficulties of our practices, which is not simply intellectual. The intellect can help, but body-based practices, I think, are very important. And they're not kind of like trying to focus on anything. They're very open and welcoming. And these are where the attitudes of the Brahma Viharas are about. You open to something that you don't want to open to. But in the opening to that, the kind of locked energy of fear and anger and so on begins to be felt, begins to be released, and your whole body begins to have a sense of openness, a kind of open attention. And the mind begins to have that. The mind no longer is localized into thought, into views and opinions, into all these awful self-disparagements that we have. The mind is no longer localized in that way, and there is a sense of expansion and largeness and liberation and letting go. And it comes from simple attitudes of receptivity, of listening, of allowing, of being curious, of taking the time to allow these energies to be just as they are. I don't know about you, but one of the problems I always had with the more difficult energies of my practice were just the continual analysis of it, trying to figure out what I need to do about it, trying to figure out a practice to get around it. Well, why is it there? And so always the mind tend to be engaged in thought, but never really with the moment. Never really with the feeling. As human beings, we can pay attention. So we can pay attention in a way where we focus and try to figure things out, which we need to do. But we can also pay attention in a very receptive way. And the second way we're usually not taught. We're taught to look at a computer screen and manipulate some keys or a mouse or a finger and create some kind of a result. We're taught to manipulate vegetables to make food. We're taught to manipulate a sewing machine to sew ropes, and this is natural. We have all that. But we're not, I don't think I was never taught, meditation was a way of learning this. We're not taught other ways of actually witnessing to life in a very receptive way, where we just let life come to us without any kind of agenda or evaluation. And this is a different way of approaching the moment. Now, I just did about 6 months ago, I did a retreat in a place called Peterborough, in Ontario. We have a Peterborough too. Anyway, and it was snowing and all that. But in the room, In the room I had the meal, there were two pictures. One picture was a very complicated Tibetan tanka with all kinds of realms of beings and bodhisattvas and buddhas and one of those Tibetan iconographic wonders. And my mind looking at that was really engaged in trying to figure it out. What's that bodhisattva doing and how does that run? And there's the Four Noble Truths there. So my mind was engaged in trying to figure something out. That's one way we use the mind. And on the other wall, it was interesting, there was an abstract painting. And my first reaction was, is that art? But then I stopped that and then I just looked at it. And it's not something you're going to figure out intellectually, Viradhammo. This is different. And then I just let the colors come to me. I just let the painting come to me. And that was a different experience. That was very peaceful, actually. Very, very peaceful. I never figured out what the painting was about, but I don't think that was the point of it. So, and we can engage in life in both ways, and we have to in both ways. So one emphasizes the object. So I'm looking at the tanka. And I see all these figurines and I'm figuring it out from all my historical background. And the other doesn't emphasize the object, it emphasizes the looking. Yeah? It's a different emphasis. Yeah? And I think awareness practice, we're emphasizing more the awareness rather than the object. The object is what tends to fool us through desire, through habitual reactions. We get caught in the objects of consciousness, the objects of the body, pain, pleasure, thought, analysis, the emotions, our attention is preoccupied or taken up by objects. And it's very, very, and those objects which really preoccupy us and take up our attention are the very addictive ones, the very obsessive ones, strong sense of self. Strong sense of me and you and others. So when you see, like if I'm really angry at someone, right, what happens is there's not only the energy of the anger, but my whole attention is now caught up with the object of anger and I become angry and I blame and then I blame myself maybe, but there's a tremendous preoccupation with this changing scenario, objects. Now to actually feel all that and come to a different way of relationship to say, anger feels this way, is emphasizing the knowing rather than the object, emphasizing the listening rather than the sound, emphasizing the looking rather than the object you're looking at. And that shift of attention, I think is very important in the spiritual life, because that's the shift, I think, that opens the gateway to the unchanged.